72 kilometers per degree of arc. In 1637, Norwood's masterwork of navigation, The Seaman's Practice, was published and found an immediate following. It went through 17 editions and was still in print 25 years after his death. Norwood returned to Bermuda with his family, becoming a successful planter and devoting his leisure hours to his first love, trigonometry. He survived there for 38 years, and it would be pleasing to report that he passed this span in happiness and adulation. In fact, he didn't. On the crossing from England, his two young sons were placed in a cabin with the Reverend Nathaniel White, and somehow so successfully traumatized the young vicar that he devoted much of the rest of his career to persecuting Norwood in any small way he could think of. Norwood's two daughters brought their father additional pain by making poor marriages. One of the husbands, possibly incited by the vicar, continually laid small charges against Norwood in court, causing him much exasperation and necessitating repeated trips across Bermuda to defend himself. Finally, in the 1650s, witch trials came to Bermuda, and Norwood spent his final years in severe unease that his papers on trigonometry, with their arcane symbols, would be taken as communications with the devil, and that he would be treated to a dreadful execution. So little is known of Norwood that it may in fact be that he deserved his unhappy declining years. What is certainly true is that he got them. Meanwhile, the momentum for determining the Earth's circumference passed to France. There, the astronomer Jean Picard devised an impressively complicated method of triangulation involving quadrants, pendulum clocks, zenith sectors, and telescopes for observing the motions of the moons of Jupiter. After 2 years of trundling and triangulating his way across France, in 1669 he announced a more accurate measure of 110.46 kilometers for 1 degree of arc. This was a great source of pride for the French, but it was predicated on the assumption that the Earth was a perfect sphere, which Newton now said it was not. To complicate matters, after Picard's death, the father and son team of Giovanni and Jacques Cassini repeated Picard's experiments over a larger area and came up with results that suggested that the Earth was fatter not at the equator, but at the poles. But Newton, in other words, was exactly wrong. It was this that prompted the Academy of Sciences to dispatch Bouguer and La Condamine to South America to take new measurements. They chose the Andes because they needed to measure near the equator to determine if there really was a difference in sphericity there, and because they reasoned that mountains would give them good sight lines. In fact, the mountains of Peru were so constantly lost in cloud that the team often had to wait weeks for an hour's clear surveying. On top of that, they had selected one of the most nearly impossible terrains on Earth. Peruvians refer to their landscape as muy accidentado, much accidented, and this it most certainly is. The French had not only to scale some of the world's most challenging mountains, mountains that defeated even their mules, but to reach the mountains they had to ford wild rivers, hack their way through jungles, and cross miles of high, stony desert, nearly all of it uncharted and far from any source of supplies. But Bouguer and La Condamine were nothing if not tenacious, and they stuck to the task for 9.5 long, grim, sun-blistered years. Shortly before concluding the project, they received word that a second French team, taking measurements in northern Scandinavia, and facing notable discomforts of their own, from squelching bogs to dangerous ice floes, had found that a degree was in fact longer near the poles, as Newton had promised. The Earth was 43 kilometers stouter when measured equatorially than when measured from top to bottom around the poles. Bouguer and La Condamine thus had spent nearly a decade working toward a result they didn't wish to find, only to learn now that they weren't even the first to find it. Listlessly, they completed their survey, which confirmed that the first French team was correct. Then, still not speaking, they returned to the coast and took separate ships home. Something else conjectured by Newton in the Principia was that a plumb bob hung near a mountain would incline very slightly toward the mountain, affected by the mountain's gravitational mass as well as by the Earth's. This was more than a curious fact. If you measured the deflection accurately and worked out the mass of the mountain, you could calculate the universal gravitational constant, that is, the basic value of gravity known as G, and along with it, the mass of the Earth. Bouguer and Lacondamine had tried this on Peru's Mount Chimborazo, but had been defeated by both the technical difficulties and their own squabbling, and so the notion lay dormant for another 30 years, until resurrected in England by Neville Maskelyne, the astronomer royal. In Darvas Sobel's popular book, Longitude, Maskelyne is presented as a ninny and villain for failing to appreciate the brilliance of the clockmaster John Harrison. And this may be so, but we are indebted to him in other ways not mentioned in her book, not least for his successful scheme to weigh the Earth. Maskelyne realized that the nub of the problem lay with finding a mountain of sufficiently regular shape to judge its mass. At his urging, the Royal Society agreed to engage a reliable figure to tour the British Isles to see if such a mountain could be found. Maskelyne knew just such a person, the astronomer and surveyor Charles Mason. Maskelyne and Mason had become friends 11 years earlier while engaged in a project to measure an astronomical event of great importance, the passage of the planet Venus across the face of the Sun. The tireless Edmund Halley had suggested years before that if you measured one of these passages from selected points on the Earth, you could use the principles of triangulation to work out the distance to the Sun, and from that, calibrate the distances to all the other bodies in the solar system. Unfortunately, transits of Venus, as they are known, are an irregular occurrence. They come in pairs, 8 years apart, but then are absent for a century or more, and there were none in Halley's lifetime. The next transit will be on June the 8th, 2004, with a second in 2012. There were none in the 20th century. But the idea simmered, and when the next transit came due in 1761, nearly two decades after Halley's death, the scientific world was ready. Indeed, more ready than it had been for an astronomical event before. With the instinct for ordeal that characterized the age, scientists set off for more than 100 locations around the globe, to Siberia, China, South Africa, Indonesia, and the woods of Wisconsin, among many others. France dispatched 32 observers, Britain 18 more, and still others set out from Sweden, Russia, Italy, Germany, Ireland, and elsewhere. It was history's first